I'm Alec Baldwin, sitting in for Kurt Anderson. And today in Studio 360, I'll talk with one of the most talented actresses of our time, the lovely Laura Linney.
People come up to me and they say, "You're so much better looking in person." And I don't know what to say to that.
Right.
Thank you.
She's the queen of indie film, but her first love is theater.
Most film directors don't know anything about acting.
Right.
You know, they don't.
I'm glad you said that.
Yes.
And later, the writer Mary Carr. She has a new memoir out called Lit. And she says writing truth is harder than fiction.
This is a nightmare, Alec. Just imagine being in your pajamas, in your house, alone, with your head talking to you every day. And that's your work.
I'm Alec Baldwin. All that and more is ahead in Studio 360 right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Here are seven words you never thought you'd hear. This is Studio 360. I'm Alec Baldwin. Kurt Anderson is, well, who cares where he is? I brought some guests of my own, like my new favorite writer, Mary Carr. And we'll say happy birthday to composer Frédéric Chopin. You look great for 200, baby. I'm also very excited to talk with my first guest, Laura Linney. She's been in some of the most acclaimed indie movies of the past decade, like You Can Count on Me with Mark Ruffalo. Linney is also a seasoned stage actor. This weekend, she's wrapping up her performance on Broadway in Time Stand Still by Donald Margulies. In the show, she plays a war photographer who's been injured in Iraq and struggles to readjust to life back home. Here's Linney in a scene with Alicia Silverstone.
War is just my parents' house all over again, only on a different scale.
It must be so intense. I mean, how can you concentrate with all that going on?
So automatic, I don't even think about it. When I look through that little rectangle, time stops. It just, everything around me, all the noise around me, everything cuts out. All I see is the picture.
It's a terrific performance. Laura Linney, welcome to Studio 360.
Hello, Alec Baldwin, radio host.
Yes, 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 yes. Now, in the play you're doing currently on Broadway, how would you describe the character you're playing now?
She's interesting, and I'm still sort of figuring her out. She's a what's called a conflict photographer. She goes to places where countries are in upheaval, famines, wars, genocides. She would be in Haiti right now if she was real.
So like the famous Vietnam execution.
That's right. That's right. All of those things. And it is her vocation. It's what drives her. It's what feeds her, is capturing these images of injustice, of pain, of suffering, of struggle, of victory, and then to let other people know about it.
And she's tough.
She's very tough. Yeah, she's very tough.
And you absolutely did, and you wanted it to be that way.
Well, I think it's what the script told me.
It did.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're just responses that are... Yeah. She doesn't sugarcoat
it. Unsparing.
She's very unsparing, and I think her thing is all about get to the truth of the matter. She's brutally truthful.
You seem very comfortable on stage. Are you as comfortable on stage as you seem to be?
I love it. Yeah. I do.
It's like an evening to you, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, You're in a room, and these are your friends, and they all came to see you.
And I love, people talk a lot about that it gets very monotonous doing a show over and over and over and over and over again, and I actually really enjoy it. Because it's always a little slightly different. You can hear the music of the piece in a different way. You'll respond to things differently. A moment will open up. And with theater, unlike film, you have time. And time works its own magic, and you can't rush it. There are certain connections that are made, actor to actor, actor to script. So as the weeks go by, layer upon
you have a
layer
relationship with
layer.
A chair you didn't have.
You're exactly right.
In week
six. That sounds silly, but
well,
it's
I've had
true.
That happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, this is the second play you did of Margulies.
Yes.
And Sight Unseen was directed by who?
Well, I was in it twice, actually. The original production, which was right after I got out of school at Juilliard, and then I did the other part 12 years later when they did the Broadway revival. And it was what part of the reason I went into the theater for was hoping that I would be able to age in the theater, that I'd be able to grow from ingenue to character actress, leading lady. And this production of Time Stand Still is also directed by Dan Sullivan. So it's a reunion of sort for Donald, myself, and Dan.
And what was that experience like working with him again for the second time?
Even better.
Right. Everybody loves Dan.
Even better. More than any director I've ever worked with, I trust him completely.
Do you find in theater and film, do you defer to directors equally the same way? Or is this a special place that Sullivan occupies?
Most film directors don't know anything about acting.
Right.
You know, they don't.
I'm glad you said that.
Yes.
I'm glad you opened that can of worms first.
It's not true.
Laura Linney.
It's not true for all of them, but most of them have many other things to think about. And they don't understand actors. They haven't really spent time with actors. They're afraid of what an actor's going to do
to a movie. It's an uncontrollable element.
Yeah, there's always a period of time, I find, not with all directors, of course, but with certain directors, particularly new ones, that it takes a while for them to realize, oh, she really is trying to make the movie better. I'm not trying to do anything other than, you know, illuminate a story.
Figure this out.
Figure it out, and let's figure it out together. And there's certain things about acting that I know to be true, and that if you sort of veer from that, you're going to get yourself in trouble.
Many directors today, to me, they're like tanker captains. You know?
Yes. Yeah.
Movies are like these giant, you know, oil tankers that they have to bring into the harbor with as, you know, as efficiently and with as little damage.
Yeah.
And the acting thing is the thing that falls to the wayside first for them because they don't understand it.
Yeah. You have to trust acting. I mean, we put everything in place, but then it has a life of its own. And you have to trust that if the decisions made up to that point are the right ones, that the right result will come. But you can't skip steps along the way. So at least I can't.
You've worked with some great film directors.
I have.
Some really great film directors. And how do you find, is the relationship the same? Is acting and your relationship with directors is the same? Or is there another element when you're involved with a camera?
It's different.
It is different.
It is different. You know it's different.
It is different. Yeah.
It is different. And it's not better or worse. It's just different. And I'm so grateful that somehow I had the insight when I moved from theater to film not to try and apply the rules of theater onto film and vice versa. And certain directors will, it takes me a while to sort of figure out, like, what does this director need from me? Hmm. Where's their strength? Where's their weakness? Where can I maybe help them see that there's a moment or a dynamic that they don't quite see? With the less experienced directors, it's a lot about calming them down.
Which people don't understand because you'd assume that the director would be there to support you.
Yeah.
I mean, right now we live in that age of the fully realized writer-director.
Yes.
Where an independent film, they'll say to someone, you can direct your own script, but we're only going to pay you the one fee for the two jobs. Mm-hmm. So as a savings now in independent film, you have these hordes of writer-directors out there that have come along. And the thing that they're the most lacking in is the directing ability. And it's amazing how you wind up having to be more supportive of them.
Yes. And then sometimes someone will really surprise you, like Kenny Lonergan, who had never been on a set ever.
Kenny directed You and You Can Count on Me.
Yeah. I think maybe he had visited a set once, but I remember our first day I showed him how to read a call sheet.
Let's listen to a scene from that movie. You play a single mom raising a son, and Mark Ruffalo is your screw-up brother who's come back to town.
I don't think you know how to behave around an 8-year-old, and I don't know how to make you stop, so I don't think you should live here. I don't know what else to say.
I don't know how to behave around an 8-year-old.
That's right.
I think you don't know how to behave around an 8-year-old.
Are you out of your mind? Now, just listen to me. Now, I may not be the greatest mother in the world, but I'm doing the best I know how. And he doesn't need you to rub his face in because you think it's good for him. He's going to find out the world is a horrible place and that people suck soon enough and without any help from you. Believe me.
That's a scene from You Can Count on Me with Laura Linney. Laura, you said that Kenny Lonergan surprised you. How so?
He understood his own material better than any other first-time director I've ever worked with.
What was that experience like making that film?
It was hard. It was really
Why?
Hard because it was made for 2 cents. We did it in 21, 22 days. Literally, we were housed in a chicken coop.
Right.
You know? I mean,
I stayed there before at the chicken coop.
The chicken coop. You know, it was just a rough schedule. It was tense. But the material was so good.
You knew you were onto something when you were making the film.
Well, and the minute I met Mark Ruffalo, my heart melted and I was like, oh, this is going to be this is going to be great. Mm-hmm. You know, so it was a rough shoot, but it was, we were all in it. We were all invested.
Would you say that because you have worked so much in so many mediums, do you, are most of your friends people who are in the business, or your closest friends people in the business, or do you have a life that's completely outside of the business?
Well, now I have a life that's completely outside of the business. I met my husband in Telluride, Colorado. He has a wonderful community of friends there, and they've graciously welcomed me into their fold. And I'll never forget, there was one time he had invited me over to meet some of his friends, and everybody sat down for dinner, and there were four kids running around, and there was food coming on the table. And I felt like such a alien, because I realized, like, I don't think I had sat down to dinner in a house with people
at 6 o'clock,
with a family at 6 o'clock. And I was sort of in this weird, I felt like I was on another planet, and it was wonderful.
A similar thing happens to me. I'll be walking down the street, and it'll be 8 o'clock in New York. And whenever it's 8 o'clock
in New York.
I stop for just a moment, pause, and I go, there are about 250 curtains that are going
up
right now.
There are a lot of people who
are
backstage.
There's a lot of curtains going up right now. And there's a lot of playbills that are people are stopping, rustling right now. And it's the game on at 8
That's
o'clock
right.
in New York.
I always wish, I would love to hear all of the stage managers, however many there are on Broadway, probably 50 at least or something like that.
More
80. Than that. I would love to hear a chorus say at the same time, half hour, ladies and gentlemen, it is your half hour call, half hour.
I'd love to do a documentary film where you go backstage at so many of these venues, because I'm also talking about the ballet and the symphony and the opera.
It's amazing.
And every kind of programming you can think of, off and on Broadway, off Broadway.
My favorite time of the day is going to the theater. I love leaving my house. I love getting my cup of coffee or my cup of tea. I love getting into the subway. I love going to the theater. I love walking in the stage door. I like saying hello to the guy, going to my dressing room, sitting down, looking at my stuff.
Emptying yourself out.
It's wonderful. It's a wonderful period of time.
My guest is actor Laura Linney. We'll talk more in a moment. I'm Alec Baldwin in Studio 360. Kurt Anderson is out to sea this week. He aims to break a world record by circumnavigating the globe in a kayak. Later, I'll talk with writer Mary Carr, whose book The Liars Club launched 1,000 memoirs.
There are a lot of bad memoirs out there that are just not my fault. And most memoirs suck, the way most novels suck. It's just a fact of life.
That and a tribute to Frédéric Chopin, ahead in this hour of Studio 360 from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 is provided by Kohler, dedicated to helping people save water without sacrificing performance or great design. For more information on how you can save water and support Habitat for Humanity, visit SaveWaterAmerica.com. And by Mini, featuring the 37-mile-per-hour Mini Cooper with go-kart handling. Learn more at MiniUSA.com/info.
This is Studio 360. I'm Alec Baldwin. Kurt Anderson is recuperating from a costly, painful, and completely unnecessary dental procedure. I'm talking with Laura Linney, one of the finest actors working in Hollywood today.
Well, for me, there is no difference between a private life and a public life. My life is my life, is the Truman Show. The Truman Show is a lifestyle. It's a noble life. It is a truly blessed life.
Yeah, tell me something I don't know.
Truman Show is a film where what's on display is something I read about you online.
Reading things online.
I'm reading things. No,
Alec
but
Baldwin.
But I mean, me of all people. No, let me. I've got to recover now. There's this quote I read about you where it says, Laura Linney, whose wholesome beauty is deceiving. When you look at Truman Show, when you do that turn, when we find out about you in the film, do you find that that's true of you, that you've been asked to play these characters who are really, really very, there's two sides to them?
Yes. And I think it's because I always really believe that no one is one thing. Sort of the palette of personality, of behavior, of desire, of objective can be so yin and yang.
Right.
You know, it can be so different. So I don't know if it's because I find it interesting that then I've been cast that way a lot. But most people look at me and they think I'm from Iowa, you know, and I'm from New York City.
Do you ever wonder how people view you or how they see you from the roles you play? And is there a side to you that they see that you like? And what's a side of you you wish they saw that they maybe that you haven't been able to express in the work you've
done? I think
the
thing that's always a little, my heart always sinks. People come up to me and they say this to me all the time. You're so much better looking in person. And I don't know what to say to that.
Right.
I don't know what to say. Yeah. I'm like, thank you.
People do say some strange things.
They say odd things. And I'm really puzzled by people wondering why I'm not more glamorous in certain parts. And I'm thinking, but it's not the part.
Right.
It wouldn't be telling the story. So I always get a little thrown off guard that way.
And people don't understand that, you know, you don't write the piece. Like I would do films where I would play someone who was very Machiavellian, sociopathic even. Mm-hmm. And I'd say to people, well, that was the job. That was what was written.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're playing Hitler, you got to play Hitler.
You got to play Hitler.
But for you, I think you obviously come from a certain background. Your father was a famous playwright, and you went to Brown and you went to Juilliard.
Yes.
But here's
a misconception. This is good. What a lot of people don't know is I grew up in a one-bedroom apartment. My mother was a nurse at Memorial Sloan Kettering, and it was not easy.
Right.
You know, I did not come from privilege.
I think people have a misconception that you grew up that way.
Yes, I think a lot of people think I grew up with a lot of money. And I didn't.
And the how did the experience of going to Brown and going to Juilliard, how do you think that affected you and your acting? Did it help you?
Yes, Juilliard certainly helped me. And Brown did as well. I mean, at Brown I learned how to think. You know, I learned what questions to ask myself.
What was your undergraduate degree in?
Theater arts, with emphasis in theater history.
And did you feel that you needed to go to graduate school?
Absolutely, I did. I knew I did. My father, as you mentioned, is a playwright, and I used to follow him around to the regional theaters and see his plays, and I would watch these ingenues who were so wonderful, like flowers. They were gorgeous, and they'd get to a certain age, and they'd fall apart.
Because?
They just couldn't, because they were only acting on instinct. And they would get to the more complicated roles, and they couldn't.
And they hadn't learned to act.
They didn't know what to do. Right. And I thought, oh God. Like, go get yourself trained. And because I wanted a long life in the theater, I really, you know, I want to play the nurse in Romeo and Juliet, hopefully, when I'm older.
You have three films that are in post-production now or about to be released. And one of them is Sympathy for Delicious. The other is The Details. And the other is called Morning, correct?
Mm-hmm.
You like to work.
I do.
You like to work.
I do.
What's the longest you've ever taken off from work?
Not long. Actually, I took a lot of last year off.
Why?
Which was...
Well, what happened last year that you decided?
It was timed, and I realized I wasn't having a life, you know, and I love the work. I love it, and I could be one of those people who just works
lights
nonstop.
One off the other.
That's right, but it would be nice to attend a birthday party every once in a while, to show up for a wedding, to go to a family reunion.
When you stopped working, how did that feel?
Pretty good. I also got married, so it gave us some time to be together, and I got to watch the seasons change. You know, I got to really enjoy it. That's what I miss the most, I think, is celebrating each season. I love spring, I love fall, I love winter, and I got to actually engage in the world in a way that I, you know, have opted not to for a while.
Talk for a minute, if you would, about Big C.
Ooh, the Big C.
And talk about your mom.
And my mother.
Right.
The Big C is a Showtime series, which is about a woman who has terminal cancer, hence the title of the series. I'm executive producing and starring in it, and it's a comedy about a woman who has cancer.
What was it that made you decide you wanted to pull into that harbor?
I wasn't looking to do a series, but it came to me during a time in my life where I'd lost some friends, and I was thinking about mortality constantly. And
is getting married a part of it as well?
I'm sure. And it was sort of just dealing with all the things that I had really been stewing over. And I thought, well, why not? This is a worthy thing to explore. And in some ways, an impossible task. And that always gets me a little interested.
And what about your
mother? I'm looking forward to it. My mother was a nurse at Sloan Kettering. when I was growing up. And Sloan Kettering is one of the greatest, you know, cancer hospitals around. She raised me as a single parent. We lived in a one-bedroom apartment. She worked 12-hour shifts caring for terminally ill people. And I remembered all of that very, very well. And I remember the patients who she would become attached to, that she would love, and the families that she would get to know. And I'm so proud of her career as a nurse. I'm so proud of it. So it was, you know, cancer's, you know, looms around.
My dad died of cancer when he was 55.
Yeah. And life and what we have and what it says about time. And if you knew you only had a year, what would you do with the time? And is that a blessing to know that you only have a year, or is it a curse?
And how can you get better at acting like you only have a year?
That's right, yeah.
And take every day one day at a time.
There's a fantastic expression that Josie Abbott told me once. Do you remember her? She was a director in the
yes.
theater. She's no longer with us. But there was a first day of rehearsal, and she goes, okay, we don't have a lot of time, so we have to work very slowly. And it's one of my favorite expressions. And whenever I get a little crazy or tweaked or start to twizzle out on a set or because of work or just crazy things about life, I always sort of, you know, use that. It's a bit of a mantra of mine.
Laura Linney,
all right,
thanks.
One second, though.
Oh, go ahead.
Good job, man. Well done.
Well,
it's
I was dying to talk to you.
For you.
Well, but I was dying to
this
talk to you because it's easier to talk to people who you sit and read everything and go, okay, we got a lot of stuff to talk about here. Yeah. This is going to be good. Anyway, well, Laura Linney, thank you so much for coming
you.
In.
I thoroughly enjoyed this. Great to see you.
You too. Pleasure. Laura Linney's series The Big C debuts on Showtime this summer. You can see a preview at studio360.org. I'm Alec Baldwin in for Kurt Anderson today. This month marked Frederick Chopin's 200th birthday. That big round number is a good excuse to remind ourselves what makes this great artist great. Concert pianist Garrick Olson is the go-to guy for Chopin. He recorded the composer's complete piano works. He explained Chopin's revolutionary impact to WNYC's Sarah Fischko.
Garrick Olson had his first big Chopin experience at age 9, hearing Artur Rubinstein, one of the great star pianists of an earlier era, in a packed-to-the-rafters all-Chopin concert in the 50s.
I remember particularly the G minor ballade, and I thought it was the most exciting, hair-raising thing. Talk about an experience that changes your life. But it really is something a memory I turn to incredibly frequently.
By now, decades later, Olson is a bit of a Chopin master himself, and he's still fascinated with what Chopin did for music and how he did it.
Piano music after Chopin was a different place. Actually, the whole world of music became gradually a different place. Chopin really did change the pianistic landscape. His music seems to fall from heaven. It seems to be created on the spot. It has this feeling of absolute spontaneity, which comes from being an improviser. Of course, they were all improvisers in those days.
But it isn't as if these improvisations just leapt out of Chopin's mind, messily onto the page. There are certain interesting paradoxes at work.
And that's one of the great things that makes Chopin who he is that he's at the cusp of violent emotion, always perfectly controlled. You know, he was a very well-dressed guy. He cared very much that his coats and everything and his gloves were absolutely perfectly turned out. And I think he really would work on a piece like this for a very, very long time to make it sound as if it were invented on the spot. Georges Sand said that he would improvise a piece that would just be enchanting and then spend the next 6 to 8 weeks suffering the tortures of the damned to get it down on paper so that it sounded just like it did when he made it up.
But Olson likes to open the hood of a Chopin piece and look inside at the mechanics of the melodies and bass lines, all with the understanding that in Chopin's lifetime, the piano was just starting to develop as a modern instrument.
And he began to unlock its potential. For example, let me just take several steps backwards. In the old days, when you had a melody, you often put a harmony underneath it. You almost always did. Which gives a nice.
Next, Olson mixes generations. He puts a Mozart-style bass line under a Chopin melody.
If we take the great D-flat Nocturne Opus 27, number 2, and we put an Alberti bass under it, it might sound something like this. It'll sound very ordinary. By the time you get to Chopin, he's expanding things terrifically. And he puts it all under one pedal. It's written right in the score. And in doing so, he provides a magical framework because all of the resonances of all the notes underneath begin to gather into this harmonic glow. So you begin to see and hear how the timbre is so important. The music grows out of the piano and into the piano. It's written for the piano only. The timbre itself becomes an element of the music. If you remember my silly example, that would be okay, but it wouldn't make people's eyes roll back in their heads the way they do when you hear a good performance of this piece. There wouldn't be this absolute ecstasy of sound and melody and timbre and all kinds of things at work. No piano music before Chopin had ever been quite so glamorous. I mean, just think of that nocturne I was just citing. I mean, where you just, oh! or even the most famous of all the nocturnes, which is so beautiful, one forgets how beautiful it is. You know, a piece that's become virtually hackneyed and over-orchestrated, but it's of such a compelling beauty and I use the word glamour in the very best sense.
So the question for this pianist, who has spent his life playing and understanding Chopin, is how hard is it to play? Is it all sweat and agony?
With Chopin, it's not so much the sweat and the agony, although there's plenty of it. But his difficulty is of a kind of organic athleticism. You know, the kind you see perhaps in ice skating or in great athletic endeavors where the accomplishment is incredibly hard, but once you accomplish it, it's not usually so much of a strain. If you're doing a triple Lutz, you do a triple Lutz and the ice skater leaps up and you say, you know, and you therefore ignore the hundreds of hours that it took them to get to that place.
Such a one-man hit factory.
Oh gosh, wasn't he? And that combined with his incredible melodic gifts, he is a one-man hit parade. He's a one-man top of the charts guy. And that's another astounding thing about Chopin is his popularity, which has been present since the day he was alive. You'll play something like this. You'll say, oh, I love Chopin. People that have this heartfelt, instant response. So he's, you know, he appeals right across the board, and yet the artists in his time who admired him were the greatest artists of the day. Liszt, Mendelssohn, Schumann, these were the finest and the best, and they were all driven nuts by this guy.
And with that, Garrick Olson glides into Chopin's revolutionary etude, soaring over the ice for a clean landing and a perfect skate. For Studio 360, I'm Sarah Fischko.
Garrick Olson is playing Chopin in Milwaukee next weekend. I'm Alec Baldwin, sitting in for Kurt Anderson, who is locked in the trunk of my Toyota. Mary Carr caused a sensation in the mid-1990s and shows no sign of letting up. Her memoir, The Liars' Club, told the story of a hard-knocked childhood in East Texas. It was a tremendous critical and commercial success. She continued the story in Cherry. Carr's recent book, Lit, is an unsparing account of her marriage, her problems with alcohol, and becoming a writer. The book was recommended to me, and you won't find a more scorchingly honest, vivid writer than Mary Carr. So it's my pleasure to have her joining me in the studio. Mary, hello.
Alec Baldwin. I'm so excited to see you. There you are, you're the big bad self.
Here I am, my bad self. I want to ask you, which was harder for you, would you say, in all three of the books? Because the three books, Liars Club, Cherry, and Lit, are they really of one? Would you say that's true?
You know, it's funny you say that. Lit was clearly the hardest. I mean, in Liars Club, you know, people thought I was Huck Finn or something. You know, I was Scout in To Kill a Mockingbird. And I was also short and unemployed and illiterate. You know, I was a kid. And in Cherry, you know, I discovered the wonderful world of pharmaceuticals, drugs and alcohol. So we could blame it on that or hormones or something. But when you got up to Lit, if somebody was a jerk, it was me. You know, plus I was writing about my son's father and...
In Lit,
yeah, writing about, you know, him.
And I read somewhere where you said at first you pulled your punches about that and you wanted to be a little more delicate about that. Then you finally decided, the hell with that, I've got to write the book I need to write.
Well, exactly. I mean, my job is not to just set down events that happen to me. My job is to create an experience for a reader. So, I threw away 2,000 pages, finished pages.
Why did you throw those pages out?
Because they sucked. Because they were not...
How do you know they sucked?
I just know.
You just knew. There was an instinct you had.
Oh, yeah. I wrote this book through three times. And when people, and that means that each chapter in there I had written over and over and over and over.
Over the period of what time?
7 years.
So for seven, you took 7 years worth of work.
Yes.
And chucked it.
Because
it wasn't what?
It wasn't true. It's not that the events didn't happen. I mean, you know, that's why I didn't want to write another drunkalogue. You know, like, you know, I went here and got drunk. I went there and got drunk. I slept with this person. I cracked up this car. Et cetera, et cetera. And I don't want to read those books. I mean, they're tedious. So I realized that I could just tell a story like, you know, I sat on the back porch, which was 2 feet by 2 feet, and drank Jack Daniels and listened to blues on the headphones, you know, till my head flipped back like a Pez dispenser, you know? And that was the highlight of my day. That's, you know, not teaching at Harvard, not my blonde, ringleted little boy, but that was what I fought all day to get at. I was the bad mom in the after-school special. That was me.
What's harder for you to do? Is it harder for you to think about all these things in your life and really examine them and lay it all in whatever configuration, end-to-end, or to arrange it for you to look at it, or is it harder for you to put it into words on the page?
Much harder to put it into words. And again, I'm trying to do what a novelist does. I'm not just setting down the events. I'm trying to create an experience for a reader so that they go into that experience. So I ask myself, you know, I had a sense that my daddy left me when I was a little girl. The truth is, I got in a truck with a bunch of drug dealers with surfboards stuffed with marijuana, strapped to the top of the car.
And headed out to Huntington Beach.
Really? And yeah. Moved to California. That's exactly right. So I left him. So I would ask myself, what evidence did you have that he left you? And I would go through my memories and try to think. And then I realized that soundbite we remember in these tidy little pieces was wrong. You know, this way I thought of my life was, in fact, incorrect.
I remember when I was going through a similar period of kind of analysis and so forth, that there was, you know, because my mother was a housewife with six children and no money, and my father was at work all the time. And my mother came from the fear school of parenting. You know, you do this or I'm going to kill you. You mm-hmm. do this or I'm going to withhold this from you.
Why didn't I think of that?
Well, this is all she had. You know, both my parents didn't, they couldn't ply you with vacations and boats and finished basements and all this other stuff. So my mother was, for a period, not always, she was this very, very agitated woman.
That's a nice word for it.
I'm trying to be as polite as possible.
She was capital N nervous.
I'm not just saying this because it's public radio. My mother is surviving. She's still around.
God love her.
Yeah. And this therapist said to me, how did you feel about your dad? And through all this kind of sobbing I was doing, I said, I love my dad. I love my dad. And the guy said, no, but really, how did you feel about your dad? I said, I love my dad. He asked me again. I said, you know, what's your game? What's going on? He said, how do you feel about the fact that your dad let you take all his lumps? And my point is that all of a sudden you can be a certain age. You can be 25, you can be 30, you can be 35, and your whole view of your childhood just shifts.
That's exactly right. The world whirls around and you're standing in a different spot.
Exactly.
That's exactly right.
Did you feel that way?
I could not have written The Liars Club. I couldn't have started off on this saga, as you might call it. The truth ambushes you. You think you know the truth. You can't handle the truth.
Yeah.
You know, it's...
Most people can't.
Yeah, exactly. It's scary.
You read these books, and I hope you trust. I don't mean this with any kind of judgment at all. You read these books, and by your own words, I mean, you're somebody who's smoked and licked and drank and poked and sucked and rolled under
Alec,
and rolled
my
over
goodness.
Every
oh
kind of
my.
Drug and alcohol. You really
you make me sound like some bedraggled slattern.
No. I'm talking about in terms of
drugs
and alcohol and just and dangerous places. And
oh,
the
yeah.
Wrong.
Going into biker bars.
There's
and,
a lot
yeah.
of danger in
hitchhiking
these books.
In Mexico. I mean, idiot.
You're like that. You're like that Bugs Bunny cartoon where Bugs Bunny's walking off the edge of the steel girder and he's about to fall off and another girder comes in the way.
That's exactly from right.
And so he's saved.
You know what? God likes me better than other people.
You've been very fortunate.
Been very fortunate.
Mary Carr is my guest today. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. I'm Alec Baldwin, filling in for Kurt Anderson. This is Studio 360 from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 is provided by Kohler, dedicated to helping people save water without sacrificing performance or great design. For more information on how you can save water and support Habitat for Humanity, visit SaveWaterAmerica.com. And by Mini, featuring the 37-mile-per-hour Mini Cooper with go-kart handling. Learn more at MiniUSA.com/info.
This is Studio 360. I'm Alec Baldwin, in today for Kurt Anderson, who was on a whale hunting expedition in the Pacific. I'm speaking with the writer Mary Carr. Her new book, Lit, is the third of her widely imitated best-selling memoirs.
They obviously talk about you defining memoir and you unleashing this cascade of memoirs since you wrote Liars Club. Do you see it that way? And what did you think memoir was like before Liars Club?
I think St. Augustine, you know, the 5th century after the Common Era might have been there before me. I'm just going on a hunch. Marcus Aurelius, you know, Rousseau's Confessions, Sartre the Words. I mean, there were some other people who did this before me. If they want to blame me, they don't. But, you know, there are a lot of bad memoirs out there that are just not my fault. You know, nobody calls Don DeLillo and says, all these people are trying to write these crappy novels, you know, because you decided to write a novel. I mean, this is, you know, the state of memoir in this country, I am not personally responsible for. And most memoirs suck, the way most novels suck, the way most movies suck. It's just a fact of life. You know, I wanted it to be an art form. It's an outsider's art. It's like little weird, crazy people, you know, carving the Lord's Prayer in a grain of rice.
And so Liars Club, Cherry, and Lit, do you find that this kind of writing has replaced drinking for you and has replaced drugs for you in terms of managing your feelings about the truth and your reality?
Oh, my God, no.
No.
This is a nightmare, Alec. Just imagine being in your pajamas, in your house, alone, with your head talking to you every day, and that's your work. I don't do that to process my reality. But I couldn't get sober, Alec. I couldn't get sober. And people were telling me, get on your knees morning and night, pray every day for 30 days,
see if your life gets better. And you stay sober. Just see. So I did it literally more times than not, double barrel fingers at the light
fixture. To the light fixture.
Saying, you're an amateur, God, I hate you. No, that's the kind of, I mean, at least I was candid. I didn't have enough religion or belief to even be scared the lightning was going to strike me.
And what changed?
My son, you know, age...
How old?
Age 6, Power Ranger pajamas, comes bounding into my bed. I'm eating a bagel, reading the New York Times of a Sunday morning, and he says, I want to go to church. You know, and I just say, why? And he says, to see if God's there. Which is maybe the only sentence he could have said that would have gotten me to take him to church. Now, we did this for maybe 18 months, 2 years. I brought a paperback and a mug of coffee. I mean, I was not looking for a church. And it wasn't the splendor or the beauty or the... Actually, the church I go to now used to meet in a gym because the tornado hit it.
This was where?
In Syracuse, New York.
And was that priest who was speaking at that time someone that you liked listening to that person? Because that was my experience.
That was it.
If the priest wasn't getting it done, I wouldn't have come back.
This guy was a little Irish parish priest. And somebody said, what was it about Father Cain that was so amazing? I said, he was incapable of saying anything untrue. And as a result, everything he said was like one of the smartest things you've ever heard.
I had a similar experience with a guy that was my priest in East Hampton, where I live. He was from this Belrose Queens school of like Irish boys with that very, very thick accent like this. I went to confession with him. I was filled with a lot of toxicity because of certain things I was going through. Ahem. And I went to this, I said, what's this like for you now, this process? He said, well, everyone comes in here and they all talk about sex. Everything is about sex in reconciliation. And for the men, it's a quickie with their secretary or someone. It's all just about like a function. It's some sort of an animal thing. But women are in love. They're in love with their trainers. They're in love with their boss. They're in love with their coworkers. There's an emotional attachment. And he goes, I'm from the Thomas Aquinas school, which is that the sins of the flesh are the least of our worries because
exactly
we're human.
Right.
He said, I've never had someone walk into this room and say, bless me, Father, for I've sinned. I have an abundance of pride. He said, and that's really what
that's
I'm
what
looking
I do.
For.
That is what I do.
But that's what you want to get to.
Yeah.
Is you want to get to this place where, I mean, and it's a function, I think, of getting older. It's a function of going through the fire in these certain ways.
Well, and developing a real spiritual life where you feel connected. Yeah, no, I want relief. I am a relief-seeking missile. That's what made me an alcoholic and a drug addict. And anybody who reads Lit or anybody who knows me, knows that this has really transformed me. My faith has really made me a more joyful human on the planet.
I remember Billy Joel told me sometimes it was a part of him that dreaded Christmas because he would go to all these Christmas parties and everybody would ask him to sit down and play at the piano all the time. But you are someone who's a wonderful reader of your own work, and we would love to hear you read a part of your poem, Chosen Blindness.
Chosen Blindness, thank you. This is a three-section poem, the second section. Now I go to church. Who'd think it? We stand in rows, like graves, I'd once have thought, like herd beast lined up for slaughter. Now I notice our bodies bend in the same places. We form the same angles. To sing together, we have to breathe in unison, draw the same air into the dark meat of our bodies, as if it actually were spiritus sancti, and ourselves that spirit incarnate. Every now and then, a toddler bolts up the main aisle, pursued by a lumbering adult. Babies list in sloping arms and toothless grin. The old lean on canes and chrome walkers set down slow. People pause to let them pass. Always a list of the dead is read. Always the sick are mentioned, so your own aches seem aggressively minor. My forebears forbore this way, in company. Bread fed them, and they had to practice hope to keep plowing up the dust bowls, starved earth in rows, year after fruitless year, till the cotton came back. Happy, happy.
No,
the happy poem.
No one reads your poetry better than you do, by the way, which is a surprise to me.
You read it
beautifully. Mary Carr's new book is called Lit, a memoir. You can hear her read all of the poem, Chosen Blindness, at studio360.org. Mary Carr, it's been a pleasure.
It's been a hoot. 'Cause I won't get right with God. Yes, you know you got to get right with God. Yes, you know you got to get right with God.
I'm Alec Baldwin in for Kurt Anderson today. My birthday is coming up. If I'm lucky, I might get a card written by David Ellis Dickerson. Dickerson is a pro. He worked for Hallmark at their Kansas City headquarters, but he's also pushing into new territory with his video blog, Greeting Card Emergency, showing off his custom cards for difficult situations, like an apology for an embarrassing one-night stand. Studio 360's Sarah Lilly asked Dickerson how to judge greatness in a greeting card.
How many cards do you think you've written in your life?
Oh, goodness. Hundreds, easily.
It's a certain type of person who writes greeting cards. David Ellis Dickerson is that guy.
I had always loved light verse, you know, Dr. Seuss, that kind of thing. I'd always drawn my own cartoons, and I had enough ADD that I didn't have enough of attention span to commit to, like, a full essay. And if you like light verse and if you like that kind of humor, there aren't that many places to go.
Except the obvious, the big kahuna, Hallmark.
You come to work and there's usually something that the entire group is working on. You know, we've got Christmas coming up, or, you know, someone has asked for a revitalization of birthday masculine, or, you know, we need an animal card. The main writing staff was mostly women, between 40 and 60. But oh my God, they loved doing sympathy cards. If you sat in the hallway, you could practically smell the Zoloft. The humor staff were my kind of people. They were like, you know, 8 to 10 guys in their 20s and 30s, very sarcastic, very funny. All greeting card writers essentially want to be liked. That's how you get to have the skill, the natural skill, to say nice things, I think.
What's the best-selling card you ever did?
God, the best-selling card.
Or what's one that's
The one that I'm the most proud of. Mm-hmm. It's just a standard birthday. It says, this isn't one of those birthday cards that has a picture of a chimpanzee and a bikini on the inside. And on the inside it says, no, this one's wearing a one-piece. And, you know, with the appropriate photo. And the reason I love that card, not only is it, it's right, see, it's funny, it's genuinely funny,
even though
it's also genuinely dumb, right?
Check and check. These days, of course, funny and dumb is best served up on the internet.
Everyone's doing e-cards now. The vast bulk of their cards are really sarcastic and mean.
At pigspigot.com, anyone can submit a card. I found one which looks as if it were scrawled on a pink 3x5 card. The front says, you are a bad person. The inside has three lines reading, you have a small penis. I'm glad that you broke up with my friend. Your penis is very small.
People often ask, you know, how come Hallmark doesn't do cards that say, you suck and I hate you, or whatever? And the actual fact is, Hallmark has tried.
Turns out, most people won't spend money simply to be sarcastic. I mean, the tagline for someecards.com is, when you care enough to hit send. Dave Dickerson cares a bit more than that.
I started doing this video blog called Greeting Card Emergency, where people will send me, card ideas for cards that do not exist. Like, 9/11 birthday was hugely popular.
This is for people whose birthday is September 11th. Think about it.
Like, how do you celebrate that and at the same time go, you know, oh my God, we should also all be sad. The card I wrote, on the outside it said, on a day when it's important to celebrate life. On the inside it said, it's a special joy to celebrate yours.
You just got me with that one.
See, right.
Yeah, you did.
Because it covers both. The most successful cards I found have been ones where the sentiment is relatively straightforward, but there's an elephant in the room that also has to be dealt with in some way. Like the very first one I did was for a friend who wanted to apologize for breaking her friend's toilet at a party. And, you know, you want to just say sorry, but, you know, the toilet thing is sitting there and it's hilarious and needs to be made fun of somehow. That was a really, really fun card.
How'd that one go?
It was, I got a sad looking bulldog that had been dressed with a little like princess outfit. And I said, "I'm a bad princess." And on the inside it said, "I'm sorry I broke your throne." Yeah. And I think what the real challenge and the real joy of doing this is to take what could be a kind of touchy situation and pulling something pleasant out of it, something warm and human. G.K. Chesterton, I think, once said, the meanest habit of human beings is to be skeptical of sentiment. That if you're afraid of human emotion, even if it's a little overblown at times, you've cut off something really, really powerful and really important.
So, what's the all-time most crucial ingredient of a greeting card?
Honesty. People will pick up a card if it looks funny, but they won't buy the card if it doesn't ring true.
For Studio 360, I'm Sarah Lilly.
Here's a greeting card emergency I've come across. What do you say to a friend whose movie just bombed? David Ellis Dickerson has the answer for us at studio360.org.
I'm Alec Baldwin, and that's all for today's show. I hope you'll tune in next week. Studio 360 is co-produced by WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. The production team includes Lital Malad, David Krasnow, Derek John, Jenny Lawton, Michelle Siegel, Pike Malinowski, John Delore, and Ed Habert. Carrie Barber, Mike Guerriero, and Jess Jong intern for the show. Thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. The theme music is by David Van Tiegum. Kurt Anderson will be in next week, assuming he gets the anti-venom in time. It's been fun. Thanks.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, a reggae superstar swings by our studio for a lesson in politics.
You can get it. You know the word politics? Poly means people, and tick is a blood-sucking parasite. So politics are the people's ticks. They prey on the morals of the people.
The legendary Jimmy Cliff, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You'll succeed at last.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.